As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Want an easy way to stay up to date with the latest news and trends in the NBA? Listen to the NBA Daily Ding podcast Monday through Friday. Wake up and turn up the NBA Daily Ding to stay informed on all things NBA here at The Athletic and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Seth Partnow from Nerdist, She Wrote. Every day during the playoffs, I'm doing a live running diary of statistical insights before, during, after every game. Come check it out on the NBA front page only at The Athletic.
With the playoffs in full swing, you don't want to miss a single episode of the Basket Buds edition of the Athletic NBA Show podcast on the Athletic Podcast Network every single Monday with myself, Zach Harper, and our cast of characters, Trevon Edwards, Jay King, Dave DeFore, James Edward III, Law Murray. We're breaking down every single big playoff story, and we're doing it with a lot of fun and a lot of trash talk. Make sure you're checking it out. The Basket Buds edition of the Athletic NBA Show every single Monday morning, right in your podcast face.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Coming up on today's show, Kyle Mann from The Ringer is here, and we're going to talk about all the playoff series.
This is Nerdist, She Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday and it's Nerdist, She Wrote, and I know we're a little bit late, but we wanted to wait until Thursday night's games. I'm Dave DeFore, Seth and Mo are here as always, and we got a special guest, Kyle Mann from The Ringer, Mr. Video. What's up, buddy?
Not too much, man. It's good to be here. You know, we've had kind of a back and forth about you trying to get me on the phone, and you got me on a video call. So you did me one. You've won the battle, but I will win the war on that.
I got you on a phone call yesterday too, by the way. I just want to point this out. Like, the hardest man in the world to get on the phone, I got him on the phone. This is like my new little thing. I've said this on Twitter. If you're texting with me, look, man, I'm 40. Just call me. Let's just get this thing over with. I just don't have a lot of free time. Just call me. Let's knock this out. So happy to see your face and talk to you. Guys, there's a lot happening in the playoffs right now. We watched the Bucks and Nets game three last night. We wanted to wait because, you know, the worry was we would say, oh, we think the Bucks can come out and do this, this, and this. And then they wind up losing and go down 3-0 and we look like morons. Instead, I'd rather we look dumb the next day. So guys, I want to jump right into it. Frankly, I think the Bucks are lucky to have won that game. And that's crazy to say when they were up 30-11 after the first quarter. Do you guys feel the same way?
Yes. And I think a lot of it has to do with Giannis damn near shot them out of that game. It was an unbelievable display in the first half of him absolutely getting to the rim, attacking, attack mode. Even when he went with the fadeaway, he still got into the paint, touched up his defender, and then went to the fadeaway, which I'm not in love with, but I'm not totally against it. In the second half, they kind of just went right into one-on-one stuff, and I have clips on top of clips on top of clips of Giannis just taking all of those bad dare shots. He pulled up for a transition three when it was tied, I think, 76-76, and I just lost my mind. Honestly, it was one of those games where I just watched it going like Giannis damn near shot them.
What do
you
think the conversation is? Like, that's what I can never process. Like, what's the conversation on the bench? Is there fear to step in and like get in his head? Because the explanation that was given on there about like why keep taking them throughout the game, I was baffled by that. Seth, I think you were too. I saw where you said something about it.
No, that was the commentary on the broadcast was like, see, you keep shooting those because you might make one. It's like, what? It's like, even a 14% chance of something happens 14% of the time doesn't mean you keep doing it because you're doing. Anyway, enough about the innumeracy of modern basketball commentator. I sort of soft disagree with something Mo said. First of all, I don't think it was the first half. I think it was the first quarter. And second of all, like, yeah, they got Giannis going, but they got him going by doing ISO stuff. And they never did they run anything at any point in the game for two consecutive possessions. And so they just first quarter, they're going ISO Giannis, ISO Middleton. Those guys get going. Everyone else is standing around.
Yeah, no, I disagree a little bit because they were doing more stuff with Giannis as the roller in the first half. They just weren't making shots. They had a couple opportunities. PJ Tucker had an above the break three. Brooke Lopez had a corner three. Like, they were getting pretty decent looks off of Giannis as a roller in the second quarter. They just weren't making the shots. But to your point, though, Seth, like, Giannis was going in transition a whole bunch more in that run. I'm with you on Middleton and the isolation and things like that. And they didn't really involve anybody else. It was just those two guys. But I mean, I just look at it and to answer Kyle's question, like, as a coaching staff, what do? It is a delicate balance because you don't want to shatter the dude's confidence. But at the same time, you just got to be like, look, man,
why can't they run something?
You know,
why can't they run something? This is what I just do not understand. And you see it, like, Bobby Portis is out there, getting passes while he's moving to the basket. Seems pretty easy to do that with Giannis. And when they do it, they have success. I just don't understand why that isn't the go-to.
Well, some of that is Giannis. And some of it is like, you know, there are guys out there you can call plays. And it doesn't matter. They're going to just go run their stuff. They were running their action where they brought Middleton over the top and then hit Giannis at the elbow. And then Giannis spent 15 seconds dribbling, you know, at the same spot. The one point backing up, you know, towards the end of the shot clock to attack. And I'm at this one. I'm like, now is when you decide to back up, like, to get more space. Like, what are you doing? You know, all of those decisions were just kind of meh. And sometimes, you know, we want to blame Bud for a lot of this, but some of this is Giannis, man. And it was, you know, the start of game two, Giannis took nothing but jumpers to start that game. And I was his first five shots. I was like, yo, this game's over, you know, because I was like, if that's the shots he's going to take, they're done. And he rolled well in the first quarter. In the fourth quarter, he started doing these jumpers and taking the dare shots. And I was like, man, they might blow this.
Yeah, in the first quarter, they had 8 transition sequences. And that was the most they had of any quarter that I'm seeing. So, yeah.
I mean, some of that was Brooklyn couldn't throw it in the ocean. So right. they got some. Altogether, this was probably the worst played game of the playoffs so far.
It was horrible. Everyone,
I think
90 O ratings, yeah, for both teams.
Well, no, yeah. And so this is I've been tracking this stuff. This is the worst shot combined shot quality game of the playoffs. The worst shot making game of the playoffs. It's like the third worst shot quality game of the playoffs in the last 3 years.
Whoa.
It's just, yeah. So we're, you know, and you want to credit, maybe you credit some of that to defense, but I don't really. It was just not both sides not really running anything and just like throwing a bunch of crap up. And the Nets got into it too. When they got back and were down one, down two, down three, like they kept trying to hit 15 pointers themselves to like, oh, let's just knock them out now. We'll take, once we go up five, this is over. And you're probably right. But the shots they were taking didn't allow them to do that.
Go ahead. I was going to say on the Giannis thing, is there a way to, I would imagine like you get some offense going downhill, if there's a way to get the defense in rotation and then start trying to capitalize on Giannis's strength of getting downhill, because they made this point over and over again, when Giannis just isn't creative enough, he's not on like LeBron's level where he can like ease into a post up, or Luka either, right, that where like he just doesn't have that middle range game. So they're like sagging back. Like Claxton was just standing there, like, you know, just hanging out. And I just wonder if there's a way to get downhill action and get them rotating and then let Giannis attack in the way that he's capable.
You know, when he's in transition, if he can just get to the nail, which pretty much he can every single time. So semi-transition, if they get him the ball and he's still moving, he was actually collapsing the defense. It's just that his recognition is slow. And so he gets in there, he picks up his dribble, and then, you know, credit to the Nets, they swarmed him as soon as he hit the paint. And they made some of those tough those passes that he normally can make to the wing and to the corner really tough on him. I mean, I think Kevin Durant has been playing excellent defense every single time Giannis is hitting the paint. I mean, his hands are active and up. And so it's been tough on him, but he's just not doing that every single time. And I think that, you know, that's the issue. It's the – he could do this every single possession where he catches on the go and attacks, or he's moving and setting screens, or – attacking, kicking out, and then moving again, right? So right now he will attack and kick out, and then it's just, that's it. It's just static. And there's just nothing happening after that first pass.
And the other thing is when he's attacking from a static position, there isn't a lot of variety. He's going to come in, stutter dribble, and either Euro or big steps to his right. And, you know, Blake physically can't compete with him, but you know, Blake has always been a very smart player, and he's shown the same like move package 15 times in a row, and he's going to adjust. Yeah, he doesn't get it every time, but he got some strips. He got in the way. He, you know, made him pick up his dribble, allowing the people to dig down and swarm. And so I completely agree with you that I think Giannis would be more consistently effective if they got him the ball on the move more. I may have suggested such things in the past. But part of that is the player just doesn't want to do it. Player right. wants to have the ball at the top of the floor.
Yeah, and that's the biggest challenge. Yeah, that's the biggest challenge. I mean, you saw stuff when there were the few moments where somebody other than Giannis initiated offense. You know, they got opportunities for him. Drew Holiday hit him on a cut, you know, when the defense shifted on him off of a pick and roll and Giannis cut from the weak side slot down the middle. You know, like there were opportunities for that. They got to do more of it. It's more just adding that versatility to their offense, which they were doing in the regular season.
Right.
This is the other thing that's really got me pissed off, is they're not doing any of it anymore, you know? And I think that's kind of the big story of this series. It's just, you know, the Nets just threw away what they've done all season.
So, and I think there's a good point here is the Nets are never playing 4 or 3 on 5 on offense. When the Bucks are very static like this, they can't get anything from Brent Forbes or Pat Connaughton or PJ Tucker or even Brooke Lopez. So they're playing, if they've got Middleton, Holiday, and Giannis on the floor, they're playing 3 on 5. Like there was whole sections of the second half where it'd be like those three kind of doing a weave at the top of the floor and two other guys standing. And you're wondering where these guys are coming to dig down. It's easy to come dig down if you know where, okay, I'm going to take 2 steps here. If the pass kicks out, I know exactly where my guy is. I'm going to get back to him. And there's just two guys who are basically passengers on offense at all times. And, you know, Bryn Forbes can be a dangerous player, but Bryn Forbes' usage in this series is somewhat 12 because they're not creating anything to kick him the ball for his shots. And then, you know, he might start to get a little thirsty and take some interesting attempts himself. And it just kind of snowballs on itself. And it is... As I think you can tell from all of our tones of voice, it's extremely frustrating to watch.
Yeah, when you pit that against the impatience of like Brooklyn can score in bunches, and when they start to do that, it's overwhelming. It's kind of the Warriors thing, the like discipline to lock in and to keep doing your stuff and to run your stuff. Like I've been really tracking like the spot up production from both teams. Like, I mean, it's been extremely lopsided on Brooklyn's side, and you can really track Milwaukee's fluidity on offense through that. I mean, last night it was they doubled him up again. And what the point that you're making is like that's where Forbes can eat when he's attacking imbalance. But when you're static and like I think they ran an ATO, our buddy Ben Taylor was making fun of this. They ran an ATO to the corner for Bryn Forbes that was like heavily contested jumping back. It was just like, what? That's not the situation to try to get him involved.
I mean, there's a lot of that, though, right? And there was a lot. Mo, you said you wanted to talk about PJ Tucker. You know, it's a weird series for him, I think.
Yeah, no, what I wanted to talk about was he actually did a great job mm-hmm. on Durant.
Oh, I thought you meant offensively.
Yesterday
sorry.
In game three. No. So I don't know if you want to hijack the conversation yet again.
Yeah, keep going.
He just does a great job on KD. It all comes down to officiating, mm-hmm. though, right? Like, he picks up two quick fouls in game two. They're screwed. But in this game, he's really in KD. KD's taken a lot of shots, started the game 2 for 10 in the first half, I think. Eventually gets going, right? And you look at KD's points, you're like, oh, what do you mean he had 30-something? But it's like, yeah, but he also had 33 shots. It was a great performance from Tucker. Defensively, getting into KD's airspace, using his hands a little bit handsy. Might be a few other fouls. He probably already has 3. He started game 4, but just that was the big thing for the Bucks in this game.
See,
you know, that's really what won them the game.
You know what the big thing for the Bucks was in winning this game? Joe Harris was 1 of 11.
1 of 11. And one 9 of those were wide open.
And he was, you know, he was one of the great shooters of this era. He was 1 of 5 on uncontested threes and had like 3 wide open shots down the fourth quarter.
One was a free throw line jumper.
Yeah. Two of them. He had one where he missed like an elbow jumper and they got the offensive rebound and kicked it out to him open in the slot again. And he missed. Yeah. Yeah.
If you're the Bucks, this should feel hopeless because they're lucky to have won the game.
Though.
And I don't think Brooklyn has played good basketball at all. Like this is the thing is I think Brooklyn and especially in the last game, I thought offensively they were really bad, but I think Brooklyn has a whole nother gear. They don't even look like they're breaking a sweat out there. I mean, you know, the last two possessions of this game or of game three, you know, wind up with these Bruce Brown contested shots. And that to me, it was like, okay, you guys were just fine with that. It was good defense, but also
I was fine
Kevin
with
Durant
the, I was
didn't
fine
even
get
a touch.
Like the last play got sort of bungled, but if you end up with that shot in that situation, like, okay, it's not your best player, but it's a reasonably good finisher shooting a layup. Like you're going to get a better something than that. And that's mm-hmm. like how they got there was jacked up. But if you end up with that shot, I think if you told someone coming out of a timeout down one, that's the shot you get. I think you're pretty happy.
My only complaint on that play, and it has nothing to do with Bruce Brown, because I agree with everything that Seth said. It's you did have a timeout.
Right.
Yeah. When the ball looked like it was careening out of bounds, and I was like, oh my God, they're going to have blown this. And when it looked like Kyrie and Brown were going to both scoop it up and fall out of bounds at the same time, I was like, this is a disaster. Kyrie manages to stay in bounds. It worked out for them because in the end, they used the timeout for the final play. But like you did have a timeout, like you could have seen Nash run out there, call the timeout, and say, "Hey, let's go." What did you guys think of Bud not calling the timeout at the end when he had
when Holiday
they get the rebound, and Holiday gets the drive?
That's I think that's you know you. I think you're always better off because I think timeouts are, especially in a late close situation where. Something called off the ball is unlikely. Making any sort of timing play off an ATO less likely than normal. I think that a timeout is pro defense in that situation. So, like, yeah, let your guy with a physical advantage on his matchup take advantage of that and do his thing.
Well, and this is the thing, though, right? Like, if he had nothing, that's when you take the timeout.
Yep.
Right? You need to see if you've got something first, trying to get that defense scrambled and catch him in transition. I mean, Drew, that was a good decision by Drew.
Not a lot of coaches do that, though, right? Like, a lot of coaches go like, oh, crap, okay, we don't have anything.
Yeah. Oh, right. It seems
the second part of what you said.
Well, it's hard to adjust in real time, right? Like, I get it. Like, I think that
you can make the decision early, but it's way harder to make that decision late because you want to say, oh, well, let me give him a chance. And then it's, you know, it's 10 seconds and it's, you know.
No, I mean, there was, I mean, for a moment, I was like, what are we doing, Drew? What are we doing?
So you guys feel pretty comfortable that the Nets are going to win this series, I'm assuming.
I mean, also, Kyrie went 2 for 8 from three. That's another thing, too. So, yeah, just another.
Yeah, I the one thing I'd say, though, you know, like, we're, I would just look at it if you're the Bucks going, like, we played absolute trash and we're lucky to win this game. We still have so much more we can go to that we have a chance in game four. So I'm not necessarily ready to completely wipe it down. I think the Nets will win the series overall, but it wouldn't surprise me to see the Bucks come out with a better game in game four.
What did the Bucks to have to guard, though? That's like, what lineups can they put on the floor to, like, hearing what you're saying about, like, the defense Tucker played on KD. Yeah. But KD is like, it's you end up more than just about any player in the NBA, you end up judging how good the defense was by the shot going in or not, because he can make any shot. So, yeah, but on another night, KD goes 18 of 28 on those same shots.
Yeah, no, but it's not even that. Like, the one thing I thought that I liked from the Bucks that they figured out mid-game, because it looked like for a while Bruce Brown was the most dominant roller in the NBA in the first quarter with like 8 straight points. They kind of figured it out a little bit with Lopez on the court. Like, he did actually a really great job, not in drop, but in center field, you know, keeping the ball in front of him and keeping Brown. And it paid off because those last couple of plays, you know, down the stretch of that fourth quarter, a lot of rolls to Bruce Brown. And Lopez was there, you know, like they did figure out some things in real time. Yes, KD's unbelievable, right? He's going to go. We know he's going to have better shooting nights. Same for Kyrie. Joe Harris isn't going to go 1 for 11. Drew Holiday is not. Well, I hope not going to continue to be as bad as he's been. You know, you're going to find better looks offensively on your end as well. The thing for me about the Nets is you just got to stop them enough. You know, and that's just, they literally just stopped them one time more than, you know, the one time they needed them to win this game. I think the Bucks can get a little bit further along with that. I don't know if they're going to win the series at this point, but I think they can win game four and make it a series.
Kyle, you feel about the same?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're going to, the Nets are probably going to snap back into normal a little bit more. I mean, you got to count on that happening. And I mean, yeah, Milwaukee's just incredibly lucky. That was bordering on depressing, where it was like, where they jumped out and then they regressed again back. I know we were talking about that it was just, I really needed them to get up off the mat last night a little bit more than that, to have some confidence. If they had come out and really made adjustments, really become more dynamic, you know, that's the thing. It's frustrating to watch, because we know they can be more dynamic, you know, offensively. I feel the teams in the last couple of years would have put up more of a fight than this. I feel like that they've had. Seth, you're a Milwaukee guy, right? I'm pretty sure. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. You could say that.
Do you watch this closely? I was just going to see if you felt the same way about that. Like, how do you think that would have played out?
I don't know. There's a little bit of. To some degree, there has, in the last 2 years of the playoffs, there has been a, you know, we're driving straight at the wall, and if we just drive straight at the wall harder, it'll work. So maybe the angle towards the wall is a little different than it has been. But
I think you got to find ways around the wall. I still think that the goal itself is correct. I look, 80 paint points is what the Bucks should be going for. Like, there's just no interior defense. You just need to pound that team and just do it until you can't anymore. And Giannis can do that. He can do it on the move. I mean, we talked about that. And I thought that when he was aggressive going to the basket, we saw that, right? Like, those monster dunks he had didn't come out of nothing. Like, that's a game plan, and it works. And you've got Brook Lopez, who keeps getting these switches with smaller guys, and for some reason is spotting up for three. And it's like, come on, man. Bruce Brown, look, he's a very good center, apparently, but he's not good enough to guard Brook Lopez in the post.
Yeah.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So anyway, all right, you guys want to move on to Jazz Clippers?
Jazz hands.
Let's do it. Jazz Clippers, look, the Jazz are up 2-0 after last night's game, basically doing exactly what worked for them all year. Game two, defensively, man, Rudy Gobert was just absurd.
He was the defensive player of the year. That's awesome. What he was.
20 rebounds, and like they were actually like really, really important rebounds. I guess the biggest question I have about the series is what – do the Clippers do in the middle? Because Zubac isn't working. Morris isn't working. They've got to find a way to try to neutralize Rudy, but also defensively. I mean, Donovan Mitchell is just destroying them.
You forgot to mention the best player in the league, DeMarcus Cousins.
there's a lot of boogie.
There was a lot
in game two.
I forgot he was on the Clippers. He comes into game one. I'm like, who's that? Wait, is that Cousins?
Yeah, he wasted no time just doing what he does, like just bullying his way to the basket. I was like, please don't take a three. Please don't take a three. And of course he did. He did. But yeah, I think you're did Zubac get into foul trouble? Is that why we saw Boogie so early? I forget what it, why then?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So how do you guys feel about, I mean, the they're missing Ibaka, I think. You know, if Ibaka's healthy, this series looks different.
I mean, I think these have been two pretty close games, and especially last night, the Jazz have shot the shit out of the ball and the Clippers haven't. Like, they do have to reckon with that. That's not unexpected for Utah, but these are like the two of the best three-point shooting teams in the league, and only one of them has made shots so far. And the other, I mean, big thing is obviously, like, there's still the break glass in case of Kai emergency, like, put Kawhi on Mitchell. They basically haven't done it yet. And this is consistent with how Kawhi has been used in the playoffs the last couple of years. It's kind of see how it works. And, you know, honestly, again, these games are both very close. They could easily be up 2-0 without having to do that with Kawhi. So I don't want to, like, bang on that too hard. But at this point, you kind of want to see that. You maybe want to see a little more Terrence Mann, who I don't know what he did between Game 7 and this series to lose all playing time. But those are two kind of obvious adjustments for the Clippers to make, I think.
Yeah, I think the big deal when you look at what's going on with the Clippers, and Seth's right, like, they missed wide open corner threes down the stretch of the game last night. Batum missed one. Morris missed one. Morris missed a top of the key three off of an amazing steal from Kawhi when then he drove down the lane. He missed an above the break three. All wide open looks. Like, not a Jazz player in sight type of three. So, you know, it's and on the flip side, you have Royce O'Neal hitting threes on Joe Ingles kickouts. You had a couple of bad breakdowns defensively. The Joe Ingles walk-in three was the game.
Oh, my God.
That was like, all right, that was the dagger.
Cold-blooded.
And goes to my favorite, everybody point to the open man, but nobody actually go to the open man. Oh, and mind you, he has the ball type of defense. So, like, there's those kinds of issues. But I think when you look at it, I feel better about the Clippers in this series being down 2-0 versus when they were down 2-0 against the Mavs. And it's not even about them going home. It's just totally different the way those games went down. Now, I think there were a couple of times Kawhi was on Mitchell, and Mitchell is ascending, guys. Like, he's making some real impressive moves. He came off a screen, had Kawhi on his back, stopped at the three-point line for a second to get Kawhi to stop, and then goes right at Zubac. And Kawhi's still coming, like the predator that he is. And, you know, he fakes a step back and then gets to the rim. Like, this is some of the stuff they're going to have to figure out. But I'm not as worried about the Clippers right now as I was when they were down 2-0 against the Mavs.
It really feels like the Utah is just is like exploiting what Dallas ultimately couldn't do down the stretch in that series. Like they're just consistently creating the looks and making them because they have more shooters and playmakers on the floor.
Well, they've got so many guys, like you just said, they've got so many guys that can put the ball on the floor and go right into a pick and roll, right? Like they go into those Joe Ingles side pick and rolls all the time. And you know, Royce O'Neal has been knocking down these shots all season. So it's not new. And you know, I think his defense has been great too. But, you know, what they're doing is just working. And a lot of it is because, as Mo pointed out, Donovan Mitchell is really like ascending. Like this is a superstar sort of, you know, level of play that he's at. And when they bring those soft doubles, the weak doubles, and he's finding those open shooters, I mean, you know, like, what are we doing here?
Speaking of what are we doing here, by the way, you talk about soft doubles. I'm going to touch on it. Was a pretty big play down the stretch of the game. Mo's least favorite thing in the world, the soft switch. The Clippers, I think, wisely have like they're trying to come back. So they have Luke Kennard in the game to get a little shooting. They have Kawhi on Mitchell. They set a ball screen with Kennard's man and just like, oh, go ahead, switch. And Mitchell, you know, inside out dribbles, gets to the basket, shoots a little 4-foot runner. And that, you know, put them up. I think that put them up 5 with about a minute left. Is that? And it's just like, okay, if you've done the work of getting Kawhi onto what is that? And it's just something that teams seem to do to default to in the playoffs on defense so much. And it drives me crazy. And I was yelling at my TV when that happened last night.
No, it blows my mind, Seth. And it's one of those things where I end up just going, like, I literally have my hands on my
head. You almost had a conniption just now.
You really did. Mo just got stressed out like, in real time about it.
The soft switches across all these teams. It's like, guys, you're not switching from Klay Thompson to Andre Iguodala to Danny Green. That worked for the Warriors because Klay Thompson, Andre Iguodala, I mean, Draymond Green.
Would work with Danny Green,
these
too.
Guys make, yeah, would work with Danny, but it all makes, like, you know, it's a level of knowing your talent. You're soft switching from Kawhi to Luke Kennard. What are you doing?
You can just watch it, too, right? This. Like, there's no resistance. They're walking into it. I mean, you know, Donovan Mitchell, it's not like he's putting the ball down hard and driving to force the switch.
He's not putting his foot in the ground and turning the corner.
Right. It's just...
No, it's like, is there a rule I don't know about playoff basketball in the NBA that requires...
It's a gentleman's agreement.
And
no.
Also, teams staying in drop. Those two things, like, what are we doing here, guys?
Yeah, it's okay, so... Go ahead.
I was just going to comment on Donovan's player development too. It's just amazing how far we've come in like two and a half, three years. Like when he was taking those dribble pull-offs or dribble pull-ups in the pick and roll, like with somebody behind him in the past, I was like, well, that's a win for them. Or like when he would, you know, get in the lane to shoot those floaters. And it's remarkable how patient he's gotten at reading those coverages, and that shot now I'm confident. I mean, he torched them in the first quarter last night over and over again, and he didn't look bothered. He looked, you know, cool as a cucumber and prepared, and his growth has been really incredible. And honestly, he played college ball here and I never ever would have expected this, like where he's gotten.
I loved his jumper coming out of college.
Yeah,
because I thought it would translate in the mid-range in the NBA. Like he gets good elevation on that pull-up. And that's important, but he doesn't jump high on his threes, which is good, right? Like, so I was pretty confident he was going to be able to shoot okay.
He just bring that up. He's an interesting case in there's a lot of, you know, when you're looking at guys who are going to translate, there's sort of like mistakes that are good. And if you didn't like him, his college stuff is like, what's he doing? He's messing around with the ball. He's like dipsy, but then it's like, oh, but he's willing to try stuff. And so that willingness to try stuff is what has allowed him to kind of develop this bag to have this sort of versatile scoring. And it maybe didn't always work when he was 20, but then again, it can also go the other way. And a guy just like does really stupid stuff. So it's tough to weigh whether that's a good thing or not.
It's the LaMelo thing. It's the Jokic thing. You know, being experimental Yeah, Poku being experimental. Oh, yeah, Poku. I mean, that's how guys find out what works, and you know, that kind of stuff is great. So I guess, guys think that for the Clippers, the big adjustment is just make shots? I mean, they shot 36% in game two, but, you know, it's tough when the Jazz are going to hit 23s a game.
I mean, they have to tighten up defensively a little bit. Like, you've had instances where even when they went to go double Mitchell to start the third quarter, you know, Morris and Jackson on the weak side both leave Gobert to go chase Bogdanovich at the top of the key, who doesn't have the ball. Mitchell finds Gobert for the dunk. You know, the next play over, you know, they're pressing and they send Kawhi on the double. Nobody really kind of rotates in time to Bogdanovich. I mean, Zubac gets there, but then the pump fake sidestep three from Bogdanovich, you know, opens these things up. Like, they got to get tighter with their rotations, making sure they're in the right spots. They can't have those mistakes in transition where somebody's pointing at the guy, but nobody takes them. Like, you got to have in transition, you got to stop the ball, and then you got to get the next open man. You can't worry about matchups. If we saw it too many times in this game where it's like guys are running towards their matchup and not running towards the closest open man to them. And I think there are things there they got to tighten up on that end defensively. But we're talking about a margin of what, total of 9 points in two games. Like, it's not like this is disheartening.
Yeah, and you're talking about this matchup. This is a team that's built on having a bunch of like-sized guys.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
Yeah. So it's not, and you said rotations. I think they have to tighten up their rotation too. Like, I forget yeah, the stat.
It's like 11 or 12 guys, man.
Yeah, no, but they've tried like 50 something five-man units this series in two games.
I think some of that is fatigue. You got to remember, they came off of game seven in the day off, which is actually a travel day, which, you know, anybody who travels, traveling sucks. Doesn't matter how they travel, still got to fly and all that stuff. Then play game one on Tuesday. It was their first game, I think, in the mountain time zone since January something. And then they go again, it's just fatigue. I think that's why Ty Lue's thinking like, yo, 6-7 game series. Try to keep fresh legs.
Why would you not play your 24-year-old athletic defenseman anyway?
Yeah.
Well, no, but that's the rotation. You guys both jumped the gun before exactly. I can get there. That's the rotation change I want to see. I want to see less of Patrick Beverley. I thought we learned this in the Dallas series. More of Terrence Mann. Because the other thing that Terrence Mann does that Beverley doesn't is he gets into the paint a whole lot more and has the ability to actually score something in the paint. And sorry,
fine.
Long answer. The other thing offensively from the Clippers is they can't be afraid of Rudy Gobert. Rudy was great in this game defensively, but you have to go attack him. You cannot let him just sit in the paint, and then every time you get there, oh, it's Rudy, I got to get out. It's like, no, it's like the Raptors testing the fence in Jurassic Park. You got to freaking go at it.
PG did a good job with that.
I was going to say, the best stretch that PG had was that stretch where he started attacking the basket. And I don't know why that isn't just what he's doing. I mean, he's getting to the rim anytime he wants.
I think he was 9 for 9 from the line. He got the line, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't understand. Like, I think that, you know, that's what they need to do game three. They need to start, like, just right off the bat, get PG in there. See if you can get Rudy in foul trouble. You know, try to get him out of the game.
Yeah.
You know, but I wanted to talk about Paul George specifically because, you know, this has not been good Paul George. But the offensive stuff is whatever. Paul George is not playing good defense. I don't know what is going on with Paul George defensively, but, man, like, just doesn't look the same.
Ingles is in his head, right? Is that kind of the thing?
Yeah.
I was going to say, too, when you don't challenge Gobert, too, you're stilting the flow of your offense, too. Because, like, I know Morris, like, got up against Gobert at one point with momentum and just stopped and then threw it to the corner, and it was a terrible throw. I mean, you just end up out of rhythm. But I was impressed with, Bogdanovich is up against it, but he was battling Kawhi last night. There were a couple different times.
Yeah. That's what, you know, it's kind of what he does in the playoffs. I mean, it reminds me of when he was with Indiana and they ran into LeBron. And it's just like, okay, physically, how is this guy going to hold up? And he did okay. I thought it was very similar vibe, you know, like Kawhi is just so strong. And I think Boylan kind of surprises you a little bit.
No, very impressive defense on Kawhi down the stretch in this one, too. Just, you know, it's his strength. I don't think we really kind of look at him and think, like, damn, that dude's strong. You know, it's kind of the way I feel like people look at me. It's along those lines of just, you know, he's got some good upper body strength in that sense. And I think he's able to hold up guys a little bit more, and it catches everybody off guard. And you're right, Kyle, to bring him up. I mean, he had a great game. I thought he was awesome for them in that sense. And your point about Paul George, though, Dave, defensively, he's been okay. Not great, but, like, I just think that's a product of the whole team's not been great defensively. They just haven't looked tight defensively, I think. And that's a product to me, and that's something I ring the bell all the time on. You got to be on the court together a ton.
These guys go is,
– you know, and
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Is this going to go seven, you guys think? I mean, I think this is a closer series than the first two games. You know, if you just saw 2-0, you might think that the Jazz are way better than the Clippers, but I don't think that's the case.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think this is I think this goes seven, but I wouldn't be surprised too if the Jazz find a way to win this in six or even five, not in the sense of just close games, just Jazz kind of coming through in the clutch. Right now, who do you trust more in the clutch? You know, the Jazz or the Clippers, and the Clippers have not been good in crunch time minutes, you know, and I think that's an important thing. So if these games are tight, I kind of got to look at the Jazz. I picked the Clippers to start at the series, but I think it might end up being the Jazz to win this one if they can't figure out how to defend.
Picking up those first two games is definitely a big deal. All right. Sixers Hawks. Big adjustment between game one and game two. For the Sixers was not trying to listen. I love Danny.
All right,
Green.
We have a moment? Can we have a moment of silence for the Danny Green hive?
Look, I was going there on my own. Okay. Now the shooting stuff, one game of you know, going one for five, guys. We don't talk about Danny Green that way because shooters shoot. Danny Green is paid to shoot, not to make. Now he makes a lot of them, but defensively, Danny Green is not the guy who can guard Trae Young. He's just not that guy anymore. He hasn't been that guy for a few seasons. What he is a fantastic wing team defender. He's a great transition defender. This is a guy you can build a great defense with, but not around, right? So they make the switch in game two. Ben Simmons on Trae Young. Oh, wow. That worked better. Not hard.
I mean, they made the switch. They made the switch at halftime, right, of game one, you know, I think. And they damn near won that game, of course, because the Hawks had no idea how to deal with the press for the first time ever. But the big difference in how they defended Trae Young was they literally met him at half court. Simmons was just waiting for him at half court. Like, yeah, come on, buddy. I got you. No, just get right here. When you get here, you're mine. And I thought they did just a much better job trying to contain him. Young also played a part in that. I think some of his shot selections was worse. Like in the first game, he did a great job attacking, getting into the paint. A lot of times here, he just felt like settling and pulling up for Seth's favorite shot, an early deep three with, like, you know, 18 seconds on the shot clock type deal. Like those are along those lines where I'm like, man, that's not what you need.
Yeah, the big thing here, I think, is that, like, Trey was comfortable with Danny Green trailing him. He is not comfortable with Ben Simmons trailing him. Like,
I'm not comfortable with Ben Simmons. He's huge.
He's long
as
hell,
man.
It's super impressive. Like what you were talking about, the pickup point was way higher. They were like getting Trey moving east-west, like in that like above the three-point line area, and that eats into the clock. But when you give him space to play chess and time, you know, they're just swallowing up with their length, like, and eating into the clock. And I wonder how much they're gonna like start to shift Trey off ball, because they have three. I mean, they're not elite, you know, kind of pick and roll players, but they have two other than Trey, pretty good pick and roll players to kind of offset that and make some imbalance. So to sort of neutralize what Philly's trying to do.
The problem with that is that Trey still deactivates. He, you know, this is a stat that I've been messing around with all year. Is he spends, him and Luka actually, like when they don't have the ball, spend so much of their time out by half court. And again, the ball kicks out to him. He takes a 28 footer. How do we feel about that? So I think getting, if Atlanta starts running their offense with Young on the floor through Bogdanović and Herter, I think that Philly's pretty happy about that. I think Philly's pretty happy about like having, like, I don't know, Thybulle and Green on Bogdanović and Herter and having them try to work. I think that would be, maybe that's something you try a little bit more, but if that becomes a bread and butter, like that's definitely advantage.
Well, he's still short if he's catching the ball.
Right.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Well, there's the one. Ben Simmons has.
He's not growing. He's not growing in between game three and.
They're really comfortable going, you know, helping off of him.
Yeah. How far away was Ben Simmons on that 1-3 he blocked in game two? Like, I've never seen a three get blocked from further away than that.
I mean, that definitely shakes your confidence a little bit if you're Young, in the sense of like, oh, when he's on me, I can't get this off. When he's that far back, I can't get this off. Like, that was an impressive block. But it was also Thybulle did a great job on him, you know, defensively and crowding him, even when he was driving and things like that. The thing about Thybulle that's amazing is, like, you think you're free. He gets pinned on his screen and you think like, cool, I got space. This dude finds a way to shed the block and then gets to the back to you just as quickly. It's been really impressive watching a lot of that stuff from the Sixers. And the other thing is, when they force these guys, the Hawks, to run their offense damn near half court, you have Clint Capela on a, basically, even if he gets it on the double team at the top of the key, the top of the 3-point line with the ball, you're fine. You know, and Clinton's going to maybe make some passes and things, but that's a bet I'm willing to live with, in that that's a 4-on-3 where I'm like, if I'm the Sixers going, like, we're going to be fine in that instance. And just doing a great job, I think, defensively in this one. I think they kind of figured out the Hawks there a little bit, and I thought it started at the second half.
That Embiid was just dominant. I mean, it just absolutely unstoppable.
Now, I was just going to say, along the lines of what Kyle was saying, maybe slightly different, is if they're forcing Atlanta to run those drag screens out closer to half court, start running them with Collins instead of Capela. So it's someone who actually, if he gets the ball off of a double team, it can actually put the ball on the floor and make a play a little bit more. I think that might be an adjustment more so than putting the ball in someone else's hands.
I think they did that a couple times and Collins hit a floater, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. Another thing too that I noticed was that they were a little bit more deliberate, successfully targeting Trae Young defensively on the other end. They were running those like handoffs where I think it was, I forget who he was on, who Trae was on, but they were trying to get Trae on Tobias, and Tobias was just attacking him. And then the fact that they were having to overhelp, that was kind of working a little bit. I was just curious how they were going to be able to do that because in the first series, you know, the Knicks just didn't do a great job. Of course, they were just incapable of it because of their creators, but they're doing a little bit better job, I thought.
Yeah, that was the difference, right? Like, between the Knicks and the Sixers, was the Knicks don't have guys that can do that and force that switch. I think with the Sixers, you can force that switch a lot more. Not just, you know, Harris. I think you're going to have opportunities where you run dribble handoff with Seth Curry and you get that switch whenever Young's on him. I think you have that opportunity in transition. If Young ends up on Simmons, that's an immediate to the block type deal, right? And you can't let them find a way to scram switch that. You got to get it right away. But the Sixers offensively too, really solid. You know, I thought not just Embiid being awesome. Tobias Harris started the game you know, on fire. And then it kind of just everybody caught on from there and kept going and kept blowing up. And even the Hawks, when they came back, Shake Milton blew up.
So what did the Hawks do about Embiid?
They don't have anything. What can they do?
I mean, I guess that's the big question, right? Yeah.
Small
meniscus hit him with a bat. I mean,
honestly, like, it just seems like he really won the lottery with this meniscus tear because he didn't look bothered at all in game two. And you know, I loved that he took it personally every single time Clint Capella tried to play big. And I think if Embiid can be that sort of player, the player he was in game two, assertive, fast decision making. You know what I mean? Like some of his decisions on the doubles were some of the best I've seen out of him all year. If he's that guy, this series it maybe is done in five because Atlanta has no answer. Yeah, Atlanta playing over there. Yes, kind of feel like this is the point where they just like, oops, we ran out of talent. I mean, they ran into a team with just so much more talent. They might not be able to hang even with their scoring output.
I mean, without DeAndre, I think we do have to mention
DeAndre Hunter,
like just having to have Solomon Hill on the court is, and you know, maybe they don't start him, but they don't, I mean, they don't have with Reddish out too. They need the body. So that, I mean, obviously that hurts. And I think there, one stat that again encapsulates the switch from game one to game two, game one, the Hawks took 24 uncontested threes because that was Trey just carving them up. Game two is 12. And I think that, like, sure. You don't want to be monocausal about this, but I mean, I think that pretty much encapsulates, like, the switch in Philly's defense.
Well, just the number of threes, right? Like, it went, I think it was 47 in game one, and then Atlanta only got up 30 in game two, right? So they clearly. Philly was doing a much better job of running those guys off the line. And even the guys who weren't Trae Young, right? Like they did a much better job on the perimeter in game two.
Yeah. The one thing I think I'd like to see the Hawks do differently is obviously less Solomon Hill, but put Kevin Huerter in the starting lineup. Just put three ball handlers on the court and let's go, you know, and go from there and constantly rotate your stagger your lineup so that you at least have two on the court at the same time, any combination of Young, Huerter and Bogdanović, you know, and I think you can kind of try to start poking at the Sixers defense. We got to give Doc credit too. He completely stopped with the, I'm going to sit Simmons, Embiid and Harris at the same time after that disaster and coaching malpractice he did in the first quarter of that game of game one, but he's completely changed. You're seeing the rotations where he's going to have guys in there. Like you can see Embiid going out a little bit, Harris going out a little bit earlier in the first quarter so that they could bring him back. I think those are the things that I was impressed that Doc made those changes and moving forward, but now it's Nate McMillan's turn to make that change in his rotation and starts to do. He did a good job in the last series staggering the lineups, but this one is he's got it.
That DeAndre Hunter injury is just, I mean, it's just, it's going to loom.
I mean, it's brutal. It's a killer. Yeah. It's a killer. I mean, it hurts. Yeah.
Suns Nuggets. Go ahead, Mo.
Before we go to that, though, I wanted to touch on your point, Dave. Like, I thought everybody got too excited with Atlanta beating the Knicks.
That's fair.
You know, like that was one thing too. When everybody was like, "Oh, I think they're going to go to the conference finals," you know, I was just looking at it, going like, "They beat a bad Knicks team." Like, let's just be honest here. When you look at it, they beat Julius Randle in his first playoff run, who was God awful. You know, the only guy the Knicks had creating was Derrick Rose. Like, you know, they beat a bad Knicks squad and we immediately jumped to like, oh, they're just so much better than Philly. It was like, well, guys, we didn't like do that. Okay. No, but
Trae Young is awesome. Even though he doesn't know how to tell people to shush. Fine.
It didn't help too that if Doc doesn't start out like completely in the wrong universe in terms of his approach, this series is, I mean, and that just continued this Atlanta momentum. It was just like the Knicks had this very, very obvious. I was just amazed at how people were reacting. Like the Knicks bubble was burst. It was like, this was extremely predictable. They depended on this guy who was not ready I love Julius Randle. I've watched him for a long time, but he was just not ready to be that dynamic of a scorer or playmaker for them. So it was obviously exploitable. So they did it. But then, and then you continue with the Doc thing, and it's like, I think it's just kind of, we're evening out here, but they're just such a, there's such a stylistic difference between these two teams, like the way they approach, like the pick and roll reps are like really, really lopsided in terms of like what Atlanta's trying to do. I think you're right. I think you just put Herter played great in that game. I'm legitimately convinced that Herter is going to be a great NBA player. I like him a lot. He's just so fluid. He's more flexible and athletic than I think people give him credit for. I mean, it's the cliche thing, the white guy thing that you get into there with that. But I just think that they should. I agree with whichever one of you all said it. It's just like, get more, just go all in, because you're not going to be able to stop. You're not going to be able to go without Hunter. You know, Capella's not ready to battle Embiid. He never will be. I mean, who is ready to battle Embiid, period? I think you just go all in on your style and try to overwhelm them with what you do. Make them account for what you do, too. So,
you know, it's funny because I think Atlanta actually has pretty good size, but then you see them and it's Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, and it's like, nope, nope. It's not.
It's just not fair. You could have pretty good size, and then you see those two guys, and you're like,
and then Tobias. And
by the way, Tobias is gigantic too, right?
Like, and they bring in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Suns Nuggets, guys. Look, the Suns are who we kind of thought they were, and the Nuggets are good, but they have no guards, and this is what happens. You run into Chris Paul, you run into Devin Booker, and I'm sorry, but Faku, I love you. You're not going to get it done. It is what it is.
It's a perfectly cromulent backup point guard being asked to go against Chris Paul, playing about as high level as we've seen Chris Paul in the playoffs in a while.
Yeah.
And Chris Paul wants to murder Composo. Have you noticed that? Every time he gets on him, he's like offended deeply. That
he's taken some great pleasure in spinning Millsap like a top a few times.
Yeah. I think the thing with Faku is about height, guys. Like, I will tell you guys right now, I'm 5'9". You put a short
guy on me. Are
you really
5'9"? I thought you were taller.
I'm 5'9". Sorry. Well, everyone does because I project 7 feet. But yeah. I'm 5'9". You put a short guy on me. Me? Yeah, right. You put a short guy on me, and I want to cook him. And I think that there's a little bit of that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Chris Paul took it personally.
This stems a little bit from some stuff from the 2012.
I tried to look that up the other day. Like, I couldn't find it. Do you know where you could find that? Like, I didn't find it on Synergy.
I was there, and I don't remember it. But like, this seems to be the running story. This is where it comes from. But when you just look at it, was funny. I tweeted out a screenshot of the guard matchups, you know, when they do the lineup card or whatever. And it was Chris Paul and Devin Booker. And beneath them was Campazzo and Austin Rivers. And I'm like, this is going to be a really tough matchup. And then everybody comes back and he's like, they said that about Portland. I go like, yeah, but this team plays defense. Like, that's the big difference there, in that sense of they will defend those guys. They will make it harder on that stuff. We haven't seen an Austin Rivers blow up game and things like that. Maybe it's coming in game three and everybody will laugh at me tomorrow, but I just don't see it coming. And then when you look at what the Suns are doing with their pick and roll, you know, like, I'm actually kind of pissed off at Seth's other podcast partner, Zach Lowe, for writing a piece on the Suns pick and roll, because they're doing such a great job on the weak side spreading it out. It's not above the break and corner. It's corner and almost at the top of the key when these guys are coming off the pick and roll, and the weak side's screwed because they got to pick their poison, and the Suns are hitting their shots and they're playing their butts off.
And the flip side of the guard matchup is a little bit of what we saw in the first round last year, Philly against Boston, when Philly had no guards and they couldn't reliably get the ball to Embiid in his spots. Now, Jokic can go get the ball and do stuff, so it hasn't been as glaring. But the difference between, like, you know, Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum not pressing up on those guards, and Chris Paul especially doing so, is, you know, yeah, he's not getting the ball in his spots. He's not getting the ball, you know, on that little kind of roll into the middle of the lane, where then he gets into his, like, spins and fakes and hooks and kind of twists his way to the rim. So he like, for them to have compete in the series, Jokic has got to get 40, right?
Right.
And you make it harder for him to catch the ball. He can get 30, but it maybe makes it a little bit harder because Ayton defends him pretty well, like from a standstill.
Yeah. And by the way, only 4.5 assists in a game, right? So 9 assists total for Jokic. And you know, so he's not getting a ton of help either.
Well, that's a benefit of Ayton being able to play. Okay, fine. You'll score 30. Nobody else is going to get anything because Ayton's just going to be going to bother you on all your shots. So we don't have to help.
And by the way, Ayton running the floor hard on the other end as well, putting pressure on Jokic. And Jokic at the end of that game, I thought game two looked pretty tired. You know, his legs were starting to go.
Yeah, you know, Ayton's done a great job staying out of foul trouble, something Nurkic couldn't do, right? And I think that's also been the big difference in that matchup. The one thing, if you're the Nuggets, I have two things for the Nuggets. One, we got to figure out what's going on with Michael Porter Jr.'s back. Like, he did not look well, moving well, all of that stuff. It did not look fluid, so that's a concern. Two, if you're the Nuggets, you got to get out in transition because that's how you get Jokic some easy looks. You know, here's the thing. As great as Ayton's been, he is not good at running back on defense. Great running to the ball on offense in transition, not so much good transition defense, you know? And I think that's what the Nuggets have got to get more pushing the pace. The Suns don't want to play fast. Chris Paul doesn't want to play fast. You got to push the pace here a little bit. Makes and misses, you got to have that.
Well, aggression. The other thing is that the Nuggets are good at playing fast and slow at the same time. When Jokic can trail, right, and either walk into that trail three or he gets the big to step up on the pump fake and he gets to get moving toward the basket, like that's kind of stuff is the Nuggets' bread and butter. And when you have these other guys who can't, you know, you can't make the pass and expect them to go right into the next thing and be creative because you just don't have, you know, you don't have Jamal Murray out there. And so you've got to find ways to just weaponize Jokic on every single possession. Especially if Porter's not doing anything. I mean, look, the Nuggets are a good team that the injuries have just kind of screwed them here.
I think that's a little bit unfair to Denver, actually, saying that you're patting them on the head.
It is what it is, right? Like you don't have Michael Porter Jr. at full health and you don't have Jamal Murray. And it's a different series with those guys. And they, you know, it happens so late. Like who can even step up? Will Barton is coming back from this hamstring. And it's just, you know, it's just bad timing for them.
No, you talked about the Hawks running out of talent. The Nuggets have just, you know, the way the Suns are playing and the fact that the Suns can be as forceful with any of like 9 guys on the floor. Like I don't think we should have expected anything else. Then I think it's been a little easier for the Suns than maybe I would have expected. But I don't think that you see these two teams match up. With the backcourt situation for Denver. And I don't know what else you can really expect from them. And it, you know, doesn't speak ill of them. It's just like, yeah, you're down, you're starting backcourt to a team with one of the best backcourts in the league. That's what happens.
And we haven't even mentioned, like, Mikal Bridges has been fantastic.
Terrific.
In these games. And they just have no answer for him either.
In the playoffs in general. Just their variability on offense is just, it's just gone. Because if Ayton, we were talking about Jokic going off, it's like, okay, if Ayton wants to have like a superhuman experience and just go wild, it's like Ayton is playing contained defense well enough that like he's going to make him earn it. It's like his discipline, like, and effectiveness, like his balance of his discipline and effectiveness, like Nurkic just can't help himself. Like he really would get into these macho contests with Jokic and you could just see it on their face that they were battling. Like, and then if you think about like the fact that if they're not going to come like aggressively double Jokic all the time and give him that advantage and take away some of his assists, they're just not going to be able to create any imbalance because like you were talking about Porter not being there is just huge. Like it just cuts their legs off. And it makes it a lot harder. I have been surprised at how, like Seth was saying, I have been surprised at how easy it's been for Phoenix. But I guess if you start to add all those things up, it shouldn't be that surprising.
You guys think that, you know, maybe they need more Aaron Gordon? You know, like maybe Aaron Gordon doing a little bit more creation stuff? Well, you know, we saw him in Orlando as like a primary creator a little bit. Maybe try it? I mean...
saw him try it.
All right.
And that's why we saw him. That's why we were like, no, actually, this is a good role for Aaron Gordon. He's been the one guy for Denver in the series you can say has played well.
Defense has been awesome, man.
Yeah, no, and also, like, he's done a good job of, like, it's never pretty, but getting kind of some of those bully ball mm-hmm. points on kind of cross matches on offense. But that's, like, and you can get some opportunistic stuff with him. I think we've kind of seen what happens if you put the ball in his hands. Now, I don't know, maybe it's better the ball's in his hands than Campazzo's, but it's just like, if that's what you're going to, it's like your deck chairs anyway.
Right, that's what made the Gordon trade such a slam dunk at the time when you had Jamal Murray. We're like, okay, now Gordon's like your third four guy. You know, like that's a huge difference than what he was in Orlando. And that's also why, again, get him out in transition. Like, you do have a thoroughbred in transition that you can go. They got one early. You know, the Suns went to zone against them. Off a miss, the Nuggets began to push it, and Jokic finds Gordon along the baseline, who rips through and gets a dunk. Like, you got to get some easy touches, early looks, and that's why they got to pick up the pace. I think that will help Gordon.
So, you guys, what are you, Suns in six? Do you think the Nuggets can take two? The talent thing is just...
I think it's a win for the Nuggets if they get one game.
Wow. Yeah. It's a bummer.
Talent. It's just...
Well, the Austin Rivers stuff really swung positive. That is something to be mentioned too in the Blazers series. I mean, it really, really worked out well for them. Some of the big shots that he hit, and I just don't. Yeah, I don't think that's what I really want to be banking on down the end. Yeah.
All right. Okay, Kyle. So at the end of the show, we usually say, "Hey, this is the thing I'm going to look ahead to for the next week." But you know, there's only four series. I'm assuming you're looking ahead to the conference finals. Do you want to make some predictions? What's the craziest thing that's going to happen in the next week in these playoff games? Somebody going to have like a 60-point game?
I could see Durant going bananas. I mean, but I don't think he's going to have to. That's the thing. It's like we both thought that he would have like a 20-point fourth quarter last night, but he just couldn't, or just didn't hit shots. I don't think he took enough to have a 20-point fourth
quarter. So I want to throw something out there. Are the Suns making the finals?
They match up so well against the Jazz, man. I watched them Chris Paul eviscerates the Jazz. And they are happy to let him walk right into those mid-rangers. And I don't know, man.
With
I think Phoenix
Conley
might do it.
Being out?
That's a big one. The funniest thing of all of this, and Dave's going to enjoy this. I've been screaming all year, Suns and Jazz, not really legit. I mean, injuries and everything taken a toll.
Oh, no,
that.
Way worse than that. I believe that the term you used in our playoff preview was paper tiger.
Ouch.
For the Phoenix Suns.
Not legit.
Paper tiger.
Oh, well, listen, I still stand by if AD doesn't get hurt in game four, the Lakers win that series in five. Seth, make that face all you want. That thing was over.
It looked bad.
Over.
I mean,
but
it did.
That thing was over in five if AD didn't get hurt. But I do have to own up. Like, I didn't believe in either of these teams, and they're both going to most likely end up in the conference finals. Like, it's a credit. And at that point, I am rooting for Chris Paul to make his first finals just so everybody can get off his damn back.
Oh, look, if the Suns make the finals, and I don't care, I'm not a fan of any team, I'm rooting for the Suns, plain and simple, hands down. Every single time DeAndre Ayton has a great game, I smile about it because nobody wanted, like, felt like nobody believed in this dude that is a crazy athlete, has amazing hands. I mean, everything about him just screams multi-time all-star to me, just watching him physically. Nobody thought this guy was going to be any good. And it's give him a chance.
He basically gets blamed for not being Luka. It comes down to that. And like, you know, the one guy who got away with that, like, it was, you know, Hakeem. Okay. He's not MJ, but he's still Hakeem. So it's like, so that's all you have to do, DeAndre, is just be.
Well,
you know,
I mean, listen, I'm not saying that he's Hakeem, but his game is certainly pretty smooth.
Oh,
pretty smooth.
It is blasphemous.
Dave, don't you dare, Dave. I will
slap
you in the face and then leave.
Listen to what
I
said.
He doesn't even come close. He doesn't even come close to any sort of thing. He doesn't. Not the smoothness of Hakeem Olajuwon. That is blasphemous.
It is blasphemous.
I will walk off this set, hop on a flight, fly to Dallas, slap the crap out of you, and then fly back home.
He's
It doesn't matter. Then I will do it in a rage. He's been, okay? And I will get there in an hour and beat the crap out of you.
Look, don't confuse with getting spoon-fed by a gourmet chef as being like a good chef yourself. Like he can't
create this on his own.
No, he's okay. been terrified. No, I'm not saying that. He's been terrified to create for himself. Now, I like Aiden. I was always in the pit of my stomach. I was like, I just don't see him being like a super, superstar. Like he's mm-hmm. done his job really well. And I don't know. I think his defense. I think I've theorized on other shows that like Chris Paul just being there has been just good for him because it's helped mm-hmm. him. It's yeah. helped well,
and
him
Rubio was.
Accept his role better. And Chris Paul is just a maxed version of what Rubio does because he can score. So I don't mm-hmm. know.
Also, yeah. like he can just I can imagine like him just like wagging his finger, no more jump shots, and yeah. and making that stick. Because that's been very helpful.
And Devin Booker, like Devin Booker being awesome and Mikal Bridges being able to do stuff off the dribble. I mean, like DeAndre Ayton's job is very easy compared to, you know, yes. like what Jokic has. But yeah, I love watching that guy play. Aesthetically, he might have the most beautiful game in the NBA to me. Like I miss really? That big guy who can do stuff like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I also loved watching Patrick Ewing, so.
Okay. For me, it's Poku.
It was objectively ugly.
I'm kidding.
So. End the podcast. This thing has gone off the rails. This thing's Listen, I mean, over you know, at this point.
I think DeAndre.
No, not
love yeah, watching yeah, that guy.
I mean, Dave goes any crazier. He's going to predict the Warriors to make the finals again. So,
Dave compared Ayton to Hakeem. That's the breakout from this.
I did not. I definitely did not compare him to Hakeem Olajuwon. That's going to do it for today's show, folks. Don't forget about all the shows we got over at The Athletic. Thanks for listening to The Athletic NBA Show. Nerder, She Wrote for Seth and Mo. Thanks, Kyle, for coming on the show. I'm Dave. We'll catch you guys next week.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.